salt in the air to disperse the crowds. Video released on social media showed dozens of people running alongside a U.S. plane as it taxied along the runway before takeoff. Afghanistan's Civil Aviation Authority says that the airspace had been released to the military and advised transit flights to reroute, saying there would be no air traffic control. Most countries have begun to evacuate their citizens along with diplomatic staff, with the U.S. planning to deploy more troops in Afghanistan to hasten its evacuation. Hundreds of Afghans, including those in possession of visas, have rushed into Kabul International Airport to get a flight and flee the country. This proves that the hope and optimism of Afghans on the fate of their country have smashed due to what most here believe is the outcome of heavy U.S. military presence in the country over the past two decades. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On Sunday, August 15, 2021, India celebrated its 75th Independence Day. In Indian-administered Kashmir, the main event to mark the day was held in the region's capital city, Srinagar. The region's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the national flag and took salute from the parade. The event was largely attended by government functionaries. The region's officials had temporarily relaxed COVID restrictions for Independence Day.
Revocation of Article 370 marked the beginning of a new era for Jammu and Kashmir. A neighboring country which does not care for its own people has been making malicious attempts to instigate our youth. They will be given a befitting reply.
While the mood inside the stadium was ecstatic, outside the people observed spontaneous shutdown to protest what they call New Delhi's failure to address the wishes and aspirations of the people. They say that New Delhi's stripping of Kashmir's special status in 2019 has further alienated the people of Kashmir.
Independence Day is important for every nation, and those who are celebrating independence on 15th August or 14th August across the border, they must realize that Kashmiris too have aspiration, and this aspiration must be respected.
The authorities had heightened security, deployed sharpshooters, and pressed drones into service to keep watch over the region's capital city and prevent any attack by the armed pro-independence groups. They also issued directions to heads of educational institutes to hoist the Indian flag at their respective schools. The order has drawn strong criticism from different quarters. Meanwhile, unlike the past, internet and mobile services have remained unaffected on the Independence Day in Kashmir. Kashmir is a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts.
As India celebrates its 75th Independence Day, life here in Kashmir has again come to a grinding halt. Observers believe unless New Delhi addresses the basic issue of Kashmir and reduces the trust deficit, it cannot win the hearts and minds of the people here. Sayed Ali Safir, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Palestinians took part in a rally in the Gaza Strip marking the 20th anniversary of the killing of Abu Ali Mustafa, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Ramallah in 2001. Palestinians said they participated in this rally to renew their support for the Palestinian resistance, expressing they will continue the road of resistance in defending their rights.
Today, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is marking the 20th anniversary of the assassination of our leader, Abu Ali Mustafa. By holding this huge rally titled With Knowledge and Resistance, we will build the next generation of freedom and victory. We view the resistance as the only way out of the current crisis. We have many allies from Iran to Syria, Lebanon and Al-Quds, which stand against the Israeli regime.
This rally comes in conjunction with the Resistance Front warning it won't tolerate any more Israel's reluctance to meet Palestinians' demands, especially those related to ending the suffocating siege imposed on the Gaza Strip.
Today,
All Palestinian resistance factions are marking Abu Ali Mustafa's assassination, vowing to follow in the footsteps of their leaders. Today, Palestinians are involved in a continuous struggle against Israel, especially in Al-Quds, defending their lands. We call for a unified stance in fight against the occupation.
Organizers said this event marks the ongoing resistance until the main goals of all Palestinians are achieved. Resistance factions renewed their pledge to defend the Palestinian people and sent a new warning to the Israeli regime that the coming generations are the generations of liberation.
We believe that generations after generations will keep resisting against Israeli occupation. The Israeli regime should be held accountable for its crimes, and the international community should break its silence towards them.
Palestinians here stress on not only support their resistance and follow the steps of their leaders, but also defend their rights with all means until liberating all Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
You're listening to Husseinia from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Rezavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah. Peace and salutations upon you, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I send my condolences for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We were talking about benefiting from Ziyarat al-Ashura and reciting it and incorporating it in our personal and spiritual lives. We talked about the final position that when someone acts upon Ziyarat al-Ashura, they reach, and that is al-Maqam al-Mahmud. And that is something that we ask Allah to give us in such a time period and other time periods when we recite this ziyarah. We talked about one of the most important aspects of this position, and that is a person starts developing the faculty of al-ma'rifa bi-nuraniya, meaning that they start seeing and witnessing things through light. Because the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam are light, they're nur. Before creation, we have many traditions from all sects in Islam, all madhahib in Islam, that they say that the Prophet and Imam Ali were light thousands of years before Adam was created. This is hadith al-nur, the hadith and the tradition of light. And this is not limited only to the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. In other groups of Islam, they believe in this tradition, maybe 50 sources from other schools of thought. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are light, nur. We look at ziyarat al-Jami al-Kabira, one of the important ziyarats. It says, خَلَغَكُمُ اللَّهُ أَنْوَارًا. God has created you, the Ahlul Bayt, as light. فَجَعَلَكُمْ بَأَرْشِهِ مُهْتَقِينَ. He then made you observe from his throne. You were around his throne. You were around the arsh. حَتَّ مَنَّ عَلَيْنَا بِكُمْ. Until he favored us with your presence and brought you down from where you were around the arsh of God, and you were light, and they brought you to this world. Therefore, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are nur. Their majalis that we have, the majalis of Imam Hussein, the gatherings, the congregations we have for Imam Hussein, they are light. Their shrines are light. When a person reaches their shrines, it is full of light, but it takes a heart is able to distinguish light and darkness, to be able to deal and cope and witness this nur and light. We are in need of light. We are in need of nur. When we pray, when we do salat, when we remember God, light comes and showers our hearts. When we separate from Him, when we separate from His commands, when we separate from His prophets and their successors, we are in absolute darkness. It's like pulling away light from the socket. And when you take out the cord, what happens? We stop shining. Therefore, as long as we're connected to God, we will have light. Our hearts will have light. This ma'rifat binuraniyat is in our traditions. We talked about the tradition of Salman and Abu Dhabi when they approached Imam Ali and he told them that this is Dinul Khalis, this is the pure religion. If you understand Imam Ali, if you understand the Imams through light, through nur, this is pure religion. In another tradition we have from Imam Hadi alayhi salam, that when he became the Imam, it says in this tradition, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, he says, we are from God and for surely to God we'll return. And they asked him, Faqila lahu wa kayfa araft, how did you know that your father Abu Ja'far, Imam Jawad, passed away? How did you know? He says this in the tradition, قَالَ لَأَنَّهُ تَدَاخَلَنِي ذِلَّةٌ لِلَّهِ لَمْ أَكُنْ أَعْرَفُهَا. I felt humility. I felt a weight, a humility that I did not understand this or feel this before. I felt the weight and the humility of Imamat on me. So this is another proof that there's ma'rifat bin nuraniyat, that you can be able to know the Imams through light, through nur. And inshallah, we will connect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We will connect to our Imams, inshallah, and develop this nur, because this is Deen al-Khalis. This is the pure religion. And when you know the Ahl al-Bayt, you will know God. Bina urif Allah. Through us, God is known.
Standing here alone. So far from home, a place where angels cry, while innocent children die. Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive. Torture and the heat, they can't bear to watch him weep. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
Realizing and understanding the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam through nur and light. This is something that is very possible to do, and is something that has been done in history. We have in one of our traditions, a group of people from Yemen, a group of worshippers, good people, they came to the Prophet inquiring about his successor. So the Prophet gave him a verse of the Quran, and they kept asking, then who is this? Who is this Hablullah? You attach yourselves to the rope of God. And then they kept asking, and finally he says, basically go out in the lines of Salat, in congregation Salat, and find, you will find him yourself. See who your heart inclines towards. So they began to walk, this group of Yemeni worshippers. They began to walk and walk, and then they saw one person that they were sure that was their successor, the successor of the Holy Prophet. So they come back to him, and he says, is it him? And then the Prophet says, yes, you know, he affirms the fact that it is Ali ibn Abi Talib, it is Imam Ali. And he asks him, how did you know? And the Yemenis in this hadith, they say that in this tradition, they began crying and saying, oh, messenger of God, we looked at the people, but our hearts did not incline to any of them. When we saw this man, our hearts trembled, and then our souls felt assured. Our eyes shed tears, and chests became pleased, as if he was our father, and we were his children. So these worshippers, they understood who the successor, who deserved imamat after the Holy Prophet, who was the imam after the Holy Prophet, the guide, the leader, the guardian. And why? The through ma'rifat nuraniya. That is how they did this. And then it says that the Prophet of Islam later on talked about how these people would follow and predicted that they would follow Imam Ali, and this was true. They continued and were loyal to Imam Ali, and many of them fought with him, with alongside Imam Ali against in the Battle of Safin, in the Battle of Jamal. They participated and were martyred in such battles. So this is a hadith that shows us that you have the ability to see and witness nur and light of Imam Ali through your hearts. And when we reach this maqam al-mahmud, inshallah, that we see, that we said in Ziyarat Ashura, we connect to the imams with this nur and light, and we start, inshallah, becoming part of them and like them.
In the limelight.
As nations struggle to control the COVID-19 pandemic, scientists warn that deadly outbreaks of other viruses are inevitable, says Amy Maxman Ryder in an article titled, Has COVID Taught Us Anything About Pandemic Preparedness? Stay tuned for more. As nations struggle to control the COVID-19 pandemic, scientists warn that deadly outbreaks of other viruses are inevitable. History is clear on this. More than six distinct influenza pandemics and epidemics have struck in just over a century. Ebola viruses have spilled over from animals about 25 times in the past 5 decades. And at least 7 coronaviruses, including SARS-CoV-2, have brought illness and death. Expecting to avoid another spillover is about as realistic as stopping lightning from sparking a forest fire. Preventing a pandemic may not be possible, so being prepared is the key, says Yongmi Ji, chief executive at Pasteur Institute in South Korea. Epidemiologists and researchers who specialize in biosecurity and public health have been outlining preparedness plans for at least 20 years. The core components consist broadly of surveillance to detect pathogens, data collection and modeling to see how they spread, improvements to public health guidance and communication, and the development of traffics and vaccines. Governments and private funders have poured millions of dollars into building these capabilities. Researchers have painstakingly tested and evaluated these plans to identify and fill gaps. Still, COVID-19 has demonstrated that the world was even less prepared than most had imagined. And what makes most scientists nervous is that current discussions on how to defend against the next pandemic are stuck on the same strategies as before. As new preparedness plans are shaping up around the world, Nature spoke to more than a dozen researchers to ask what stands in the way of a better system for identifying and controlling new outbreaks, and what must change. Why aren't warning systems better? Everything starts with smarter surveillance. If you don't look, you don't see. If you don't see, you will always respond too late, writes infectious disease researcher Jeremy Farr, director of the UK Biomedical Funder Wellcome, in his new book, Spike, The Virus Versus the People, The Inside Story. Unfortunately, too late is the norm. The world's largest Ebola epidemics had been spreading for more than a month before anyone diagnosed the disease. Insufficient detection worries researchers because outbreaks get exponentially harder to contain once they have expanded beyond a limited area. The world recognized this danger for influenza viruses decades ago. In 1952, one of the first moves by the World Health Organization, WHO, was to set up the Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System. It has since provided an early warning system for flu outbreaks such as H5N1 avian influenza, and it has alerted researchers to the rise of resistance to certain antiviral drugs. Unknown or unexpected pathogens are harder to monitor, but improvements in genome sequencing techniques have made open-ended searches possible. For example, in Eid, Nigeria, scientists at African Center of Excellence for Genomics of Infectious Disease search for foreign DNA and RNA in blood samples from patients who have high fevers but test negative for the most common maladies in the region. Using this method, they discovered an unrecognized outbreak of yellow fever in 2017. This is a very good method for finding unknowns, explains Judith Agazi, an infectious disease researcher at the center. Some researchers say this sort of surveillance should be extended to people who work in forests, on farms handling animals, and in virology labs, anywhere people might come into close contact with pathogens. Oliver Pybus, a co-director of the Pandemic Genomics Program at the University of Oxford, adds that new genomic technologies could allow researchers to detect viruses in waste, water, or air, and once an outbreak is ongoing, these same tools can help them to determine how far it has spread below their radar. High-tech tracking would provide lots of data, but Moussoka Fallah, the president of Refugee Place International in Liberia, says that basic surveillance needs to improve first. He says funders often support it as a finite project rather than a sustained process, and this defeats the purpose. A case in point, Liberia received more than $19 million from donors, including World Bank, to strengthen its health system and surveillance in the wake of Ebola outbreak in 2014 to 2016, but many of the funds have run dry. In 2019, the country was facing nationwide shortages in biomedical supplies, and many researchers and health workers weren't being paid. Epidemiologists learn about emerging diseases by crunching numbers, and the quality of the results depends on access to raw information.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Peaceful march of the masses and a lot of youngsters joining in the beat. Actually, it is to mourn a grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, that is Imam Hussein, third leader of the Shias. Some things never get old, say sorrow and inspiration, the struggle for basic rights and dignity, and aspiring to betterment. Each year, this country is shrouded in black to mourn Imam Hussein and companions, and to honor the epic battle of Karbala. What the event inspires today and how Corona will allow a commemoration we'll be pointing to in this episode. So stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. After cruel Umayyad rule, the children of the fourth caliph, Ali the Infallible, ought to have taken the reins of Islamic rule. Among them, Hussein. But on their way to the seat of the caliphate in the year 680 AD, or 61 Hijra, Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were faced by what's known as the army of Yazid I. The resistance that ensued came to be known as an uprising. Mr. Tavakkoli is a writer, researcher, and West Asia expert teaching at university. We got to meet him at his office in the Art Center.
Resistance is in fact a ramification of Ashura. When you come to realize with regard to the Muslim world that the enemies of Islam, enemies of people, enemies of this geographical zone have mobilized their forces for maximum dominance, be it cultural, economic, or geopolitical, upon regional nations, the common political logic, be it liberalism or nationalism, failed to find an answer. Even the most leading anti-hegemony movement, for example Marxism, which itself grew into a new force of dominance, failed to overpower capitalism and imperialism.
Imam Hussein was beheaded, as were his 72 companions, killed or taken as captive. Among those killed was Hussein's 6-month-old baby boy. This bears the question whether the resistance was pre-planned or consequential. But it happened. The blood of pure souls was shed. And under a millennium and a half later, in spite of a surge with COVID-19, mourning tents, yards, and congregation halls named Husseinias were set up as Muharram set in. Mr. Harizavi, a cleric of rank, is deputy for Islamic promotion. He received us at his relevant office, a pleasant space with welcoming people.
This year, in my opinion, the observation of protocols will be between 85% to 90%, although the enemies try to show it otherwise. In other words, there might be violations in 5 gatherings out of the 105,000 gatherings across the country, but the enemies portray the 5 instances in cyberspace as if they were happening in half of all the gatherings and call for all the gatherings to be banned. This is unfair. God willing, people will be careful. We have good people. They won't allow their devotion to Imam Hussein to lead to a further spread of the disease so the enemies can take advantage.
Why do Shias hold the Tasua Ashura ceremony each year? What current events over time have kept the flame alive?
One instance is the martyrdom of Haj Qasem Soleimani, which created a huge movement in Iran and the countries in the region, as a great commander like Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was martyred alongside him. The two great figures fought against the enemies together. Remember, after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, people from all walks of life, tendencies, appearances, even those who didn't adhere to religious laws, came out to protest. is exactly what we're witnessing in Lebanon, where many of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's followers are Christians who practice their own religion, but their political thought follows the idea of resistance.
In Iraq's holy city of Karbala alone, where Imam Hussein has been laid to rest, over 20 million Shia Muslims gather annually to pay homage. Those who can't make it commemorate the triumph of blood over the sword elsewhere over the 10-day mourning period, ending in Tasua and Ashura, the 9th and 10th days, and on Arba'in, the Imam's 40th day or 40-day martyrdom anniversary. The nation, among 200 million Shias worldwide, are black-clad at large on the 10 days and on Arba'in, the 40th commemorative day that falls into the following month of Safar. Muharram is among months labeled the haram or forbidden months when war is prohibited. In other words, Husseini resistance is meant to be peaceful. Interestingly, the Islamic resistance appears to have been more successful, perhaps even the only successful movement against the US and Israel, apparently because of its peaceful nature. Mr. Jalali, a cleric of considerable rank, gave us some of his time as well as access to a yard he has downtown where his following congregate for religious ceremonies. This year it's been decorated no less abundantly than any time before, with motive springing to life the event of Ashura.
Imam Hussein's conduct in the face of enemy troops carries a social lesson. When the enemy troops were approaching, Imam Hussein did not cease to worry about their concerns, including physical health, like possible thirst. Therefore, Imam Hussein immediately ordered commanders and water distributors to supply waters to enemy troops. When we see such conducts, we can't remain indifferent towards fellow humans.
Congregations of believers are not easy to stop, and not everyone in the system cared to completely scrap the ceremony. It is a way of enlivening religious belief among youngsters, as the most popular cantors trigger their energy and thoughts. And with an economy in trouble, the nation can do with a little normalcy. Over the past four decades, Iranians have endured all sorts of hardship imposed by foreign powers and have demonstrated where they felt wronged by domestic authorities, but do both class as resistance.
The fact is that the end point of the uprising is to fight the external enemy. But if you have noticed, there was some sort of influence in the government itself. As the Umayyads infiltrated the Islamic government, or the Jews somehow came and made plans, we must also rise up here against the oppression around us. As Imam Hussein himself said, his uprising was one within the Muslim Ummah. Well, the unfair developments in Khuzestan, the shortcomings which were due to some misguided measures taken there, the developments in Haftape or Sistan and Balochistan, all these can be approached with the spirit of demand and protest that Imam Hussein has placed in our conscience.
The outer world also closely observes the marches and mourners of Muharram and Arba'in. It's a long tale, and we've plenty more to say on it. But first, a quick media review with Sarah.
Hello, and welcome to a new edition with me, Sarah Adema. As we are getting closer to Ashura, today we're going to review some lessons from different media outlets. And the first one begins with Tehran Times that says, Ashura is an integral part of Iranian identity. Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, said back in the revolution days that the victory of the Islamic Revolution was because of Imam Hussein's uprising. He stated, we all should understand that if it had not been for the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we would not have won. The Islamic Revolution of Iran is a reflection of Ashura and its great divine revolution. He also said that the mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein alayhi salam played a major role in unifying the Iranian people against the Shah. In Imam Khomeini's view, the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who is also known as the Master of Martyrs, is the main reason that preserved the Muslim countries. The later leader said, we have to see what the secret of the survival of this religion and the survival of Muslim and Shia countries is, and we should protect that secret. The biggest secret in this regard is the issue of the Master of Martyrs. Under Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Iran continued to follow the Imam Hussein's footsteps. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah stated in Ahl al-Bayt news agency, "Psychological warfare aims at fueling Lebanon's crises." Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that the crisis in Lebanon is being deliberately exacerbated. He pointed to recent developments surrounding fuel supplies that turned into a fabricated crisis, which people corresponded with, making the situation worse. During his speech at the Central Ashura commemorations, he gave several instructions to the supporters of the resistance, stressing the importance of honesty in reporting facts and not slandering or accusing anyone without evidence, and not to curse or insult anyone. He said, "Differences in opinion do not mean attacking others. Criticizing is one thing, and attacking them is another. Whoever among the clergymen or male and female media professionals talk about politics, we have the right to respond to them, but within certain norms, and not to attack them personally." He explained further, "Insulting and belittling is a sign of weakness, while the strong discusses and puts forward ideas and does not need to insult others." Our final lesson reads in Daily Times, "Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the quintessential custodian of Islam. The painful tragedy of Karbala reminds us not to bow down before a despot and tyrant ruler, and never flinch from raising our voice against injustice, oppression, and despotism. This is what Imam Hussein alayhi salam did at the hottest and the arid plains of Karbala." To cap it all, I would quote Allama Iqbal, who paid glowing tribute to Imam Hussein in his book, The Secrets of Selflessness. He says in his book, he, meaning Hussein, annihilated despotism till the day of resurrection. The sugar of his blood brought forth the garden of liberty. For truth, he rolled in dust and blood, and thus he had fortified the foundation of Islam. The secret of Quran we have learned from Imam Hussein's example. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, also eulogized Imam Hussein in following words. "The world is unable to present an example finer and brighter than the personality of Imam Hussein, inasmuch as he was the embodiment of love and valor and personification of sacrifice and devotion. Every Muslim should learn a lesson from his life and should receive guidance from him." And that's it for me in today's edition. And now, back to you, Leila.
We mentioned how Ashura was a mobilizing force to the axis of resistance, in turn mobilizing the region against the US and Israel, and now loose jihadism and Wahhabi and Takfiri sects. You recall General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the US just after New Year. He was instrumental in defeating Daesh or ISIS in Syria and Iraq by moving forces he likened to Imam Hussein and his small army of friends and family. In fact, he referred to Iranians as the nation of Hussein and expected them to plant the seeds of sacrifice and resisting oppressors everywhere. I asked what similarities could be found between the Islamic resistance of today and the event of Ashura.
When the Salafi and Wahhabi thought came together in the Sunni political Islam, especially its Takfiri spectrum, we witnessed the emergence of anti-religious phenomena in the Islamic world, meaning that one sect of Islam started to fight against the other faiths and sects. The Salafi Takfiris distorted the definition of the immediate and distant enemies, changing the immediate enemy from political leaders who are obedient to the West to the Shias, saying that although the distant enemies are the US and Israel, we must first go after the Shias and other faiths that don't agree with us. That's when they started to fight faiths and tried to subjugate their followers, commit massacres, behead people. the exact approach taken by the Umayyads. Therefore, all those who followed the thought of Ashura and the ideas of Imam Hussein came forward. Their beliefs have been so strong that made them give up life and enter this field. Therefore, the axis of resistance has a meaningful connection and perhaps the deepest philosophical and fundamental connection with the uprising of Imam Hussein.
Since there's been plenty of mention of Daesh and resisting it, as well as US and Israel or US allies, well, Daesh was a monstrous terror group and among groups created or backed by the US when the time was right. They're a means of using religion against religion, or getting religion to shoot itself in the foot. This has been evident in the actions of Daesh against fellow Muslims even. How does that promote the image or following of Islam? Daesh, which was, and the MEK or Iran's Mujahideen, known as the Hypocrites, and the Al-Saud dynasty, are all aligned against the Islamic resistance. The enemy is equipped with every dark force, and Iran cannot stop its regional policy. In fact, it calls the war on terror a holy war, while differentiating between martyrdom and suicidal acts of terror. The history of Islam is 1,400 years old and more. Now, there's discrepancies to be seen even in political accounts of the day. But all sects agree on the ill done the descendants of the Prophet and the suffering of Imam Hussein and companions. How we apply the lesson to the world of today, though, matters much. I went down to Parliament to hear how from a Miss Lajavadi, an MP on the Cultural Committee.
If only we can picture and retell those stories, they have so many beautiful truths that we can learn a whole life lesson from. A lesson of endurance, self-sacrifice and devotion, how to come out victorious in the face of difficulties. We can pass them on, but unfortunately not enough work has been done to recount the story artistically. Each and every person in the story can be characterized. For example, Zuhai, who wasn't involved in the issues at all but 10 years that of Imam Hussein. How he got involved or what was his wife's role in his redemption and martyrdom. These all have stories that we can learn life lessons from.
Iran's method is the resistance against foreign forces in the region and their strongholds, especially the ones slowly wiping the holy shrines and Palestine off the map, Israel. Today, resistance on another front is also of paramount importance. That is with the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, which began in April. They're in limbo, as Western parties to the deal, especially the US, are drawing talks out to get Iran to finally buckle down under the pressure of US sanctions. They think Iran may sign a JCPOA 2 or JCPOA plus this way, but Iran hasn't backed down an inch and is not likely to do so with the Ashura anniversary serving as a reminder to resistance, just weeks before the seventh round of Vienna talks.
There are many free thinkers in the world like Gandhi, who had no religious affiliation with Islam but sanctified Imam Hussein and honored him as their leader. This is true in Muslim countries, both among Shiites and Sunnis. Imam Hussein is influential and inspiring as a descendant of Prophet Muhammad and a great martyr. This has been the case for years, and we believe it will continue to be so in the future and will make more important impacts in human civilization.
Iran's support for Palestinian groups has been a key feature in spearheading pro-resistance and pan-Islamic solidarity. Groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the Secular Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Iran's support for and by the Axis stems from its revolutionary ideology of wanting to be a cause, not just a country. For and since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran's leaders have legitimized acts of resistance and uprising, if recognized to be anti-oppression. Well, the 8-year war of the 80s, waged on Iran by Iraq, is an unquestionable example. In drawing on the Ashura narrative of the victims voiceless but standing, perhaps hoping for time to set the record straight, this country interestingly did this. When Iran accepted the UN Resolution 598 for the ceasefire with Iraq, its substantial demand was not war reparations, but to be recognized as the victim of invasion. and that it finally achieved.
After a nation rises up, if it persists and values its uprising and believes in it, the uprising turns to resistance. If the resistance continues, it will change to endurance and become long-lasting. In our opinion, the Iranian people's uprising turned into resistance, then took the form of endurance, and now has been internalized to the point where they exercise perseverance in the face of all the hardships and sanctions and choose their uprising over giving up. Between resistance and surrender, they choose the former.
It was the Islamic faith that drove our youngsters during the eight-year war. If there were another war to break out now, what do you think would drive them?
As a historian who has authored The Biology of Many Martyrs and has been at the war front, I would say that those who were today fighting Daesh have done much more sacrifice than what we did. Those who are fighting Daesh in Syria have much stronger faith than our generation. We really envy them and we feel that we are distant from them.
Another example is resistance against Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And in case you're wondering how it all started, revolutionary Shiism emerged in the 1960s in response to global anti-colonial movements. It centered on resistance against oppression with a look to Shia fighters and martyrdom and by drawing on the Karbala metaphor. To Iran as a state, the tale is more than a script for passion plays or even history books. The post-revolution constitution commands support for the oppressed and Muslims of the world, and it's claimed to have been inspired by the ordeal of Imam Hussein and companions. How bravely Imam Hussein might have fought would not matter if his only intention were to score a battlefield win, because he was surrounded by an army attacking on all sides with spears, swords and arrows, and eventually Shim ruthlessly beheaded him, thirsty and heavily wounded. But not to fear, because words carry far and long, and that's all a legacy needs to be related and learned from. And this is where Zainab, peace be upon her, comes in.
After Imam Hussein and his companions are martyred in the scene of Ashura, their enemies take Hazrat Zainab as a captive and chain her, taking the captives from city to city in the worst possible way until they reach the Levant. They cheer to humiliate the family of Imam Hussein, but the exact opposite of what they wanted happened, because Hazrat Zainab was an orator so skillful that people said it was as if Imam Ali was speaking when he delivered a speech. While giving a speech in Yazid's court, she commanded everyone to silence, and all the participants in the majestic court of Yazid immediately became silent to listen to her sermons. Her speech made Yazid's family, who was sitting behind a veil, cry and oppose him. Her sermons were so powerful that his rule didn't last long after.
The merging of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance movement with the ideals of the Ashura Uprising can be seen in Chapter 10 on Foreign Policy, Article 152. That bases the country's foreign policy on the rejection of any kind of domination, the preservation of all-inclusive independence of the country, the defense of the rights of all Muslims, and non-alignment in relation to domineering powers.
Iran's Islamic Revolution was a phenomenon that was 15 years in the making from the year 1964 and gradually became complete. During the course of time, the leadership found its meaning and the Imam found its true place. That was made possible by Muslims with lofty aspirations and motives.
The Islamic Revolution started from religious morning gatherings. These gatherings have been special as they recount the truths about Ashura and underline the importance of fighting against evil, although with a few fighters. This is significant as people are shown how to follow the truth in the way Imam Hussein and his companions did.
We said the Islamic resistance had been successful. Since 1979, revolutionary Shiism has linked Tehran with a network of Shia groups in the region. These include Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Hashdash Shaabi in Iraq, and the Houthis in Yemen. And it's not just a matter of fighting power, but winning the hearts and minds of regional brethren.
Basically, any uprising that arises to fight against oppression becomes permanent and truth-seeking, and righteous people will follow it. The uprising of Ashura is a complete tragedy due to its unique historical characteristics. It's an event in which women and children were involved from its creation until it ended in conveying the message of resistance and perseverance.
That would be the end of our account of the day. Thanks from the whole team. But we've an account a week, so do join us again at the same times next week and each week after. Till then, bye.
Sex scandals are back in the news. In one of the latest cases, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has just resigned after another official inquiry revealed that 11 women had accused the Democrat of groping or sexually harassing them.
Since sharing my story, six more women have come forward with their experience of being bullied, harassed, and assaulted by the governor of New York. When the governor lies about his abuse of power, as he's doing right now and daily, it's a betrayal of the public's trust.
Yet this kind of behavior has gone on forever in U.S. politics on both sides of the aisle.
They reviewed more than 74,000 pieces of evidence, including documents, emails, texts, audio files, and pictures. These interviews and pieces of evidence reveal a deeply disturbing yet clear picture. Governor Cuomo sexually harassed current and former state employees in violation of both federal and state laws.
In the past 20 years, most governors who have resigned got caught in sex scandals of one sort or another. When Andrew Cuomo was elected Attorney General of New York in 2006, he succeeded Eliot Spitzer, who was elected to the governor's office that year. Spitzer's term as governor would last a mere 15 months after it was revealed he regularly visited prostitutes at Washington, D.C.'s famed Mayflower Hotel. Cuomo's successor in the role of state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman, stepped down in 2018 following a report that he had physically abused several women he had dated. The list of American political figures who have been accused of sexual harassment or assault is too long, even in the wake of the Me Too movement, which started in 2017. As for the former U.S. president, more than two dozen women have publicly accused Trump of sexual harassment or assault. Just weeks before the 2016 election, a recording from 2005 surfaced of Trump boasting in vulgar terms about kissing and groping women without their consent. Trump acknowledged his remarks at the time, but he also dismissed the conversation as locker room talk.
This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it, but this is locker room talk.
Later in 2019, the writer of E. Jean Carroll accused Trump of raping her in the dressing room of a department store in New York City. In an unusual move, Trump brought in the Justice Department to defend him.
It was a stunning and shocking day, but for all women in the country, Robbie and Joshua are fighting to right this wrong. A woman who makes a complaint against a powerful man, women in this country must be assured that her case will not be tossed off to the DOJ.
In 2017, Leanne Tweeden, a comedian and sports broadcaster, accused Al Franken, a Democratic senator from Minnesota, of forcibly kissing her during a rehearsal, of groping her for a photo while she slept during a 2006 comedy tour through the Middle East. In late 2017, a number of women said that Roy S. Moore, at the time a Republican candidate for Senate in Alabama, had made sexual advances towards them when they were teenagers and he was in his 30s. Then President Trump, however, endorsed Moore about a week before the election.
He stopped the car and he parked his car in between the dumpster and the back of the restaurant, where there were no lights. The area was dark and it was deserted. I was alarmed and I immediately asked him what he was doing. Instead of answering my questions, Mr. Moore reached over and began groping me.
Soon after Trump nominated Brett M. Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court in 2018, three women accused him of sexual assault or misconduct. Kavanaugh denied the allegation and was confirmed to the court by one of the slimmest margins in American history. Perhaps the most scandalous case in the modern history of U.S. politics is that of Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, a White House intern back in 1995. Clinton admitted that he had an inappropriate relationship with Lewinsky. As president, he was impeached, however, for lying under oath to a federal judge, not because of having sex with Lewinsky, though that was the context. During the impeachment investigation of Clinton, it turned out then House Speaker Newt Gingrich was having an affair of his own. Gingrich was then seeing Callista Bizek. He was leaving his wife Marianne Ginther, with whom he was having an affair while married to his first wife, Jackie Gingrich. Among the less heard cases is the sexual misconduct of John F. Kennedy, as chronicled by Seymour Hersh in The Dark Side of Camelot. That includes Kennedy's involvement with mob mole Judith Campbell Exner and Helen Romage, an agent working for the East German STASI, an extension of the Soviet KGB. These days, American politicians don't feel compelled to step down over sexual harassment. Donald Trump slept with at least one porn star and paid off mistresses to keep them quiet. Yet he shrugged off endless claims of inappropriate behavior. His fellow Republican Matt Gaetz has also refused to quit, even after he got caught up in a dirty scandal. Reported payment records suggest that Gaetz paid $900 to a fellow politician operator who then allegedly wired $900 to three teenage girls almost 8 minutes later. The same is true about Democrats. The Democratic Party stuck by Joe Biden after a former staff member, Tara Reid, accused him of sexual assault. Even before he formally entered the Democratic presidential race, a former Nevada assemblywoman accused Biden in March 2019 of inappropriately touching her and kissing her on the head at a campaign rally in 2014. Despite the advent of the Me Too movement, meant to protect vulnerable women, sexual abuse has mostly been politicized in the US, a weapon being used by politicians to defeat their rivals. As sex scandals rage on across the US political stage, women's rights per se still remain a low priority.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.